wouldn't let myself be intimidated by the unknown. Have I changed that much? You're only in your 30s. Are you really an old man? He doesn't answer. He downs his drink in one gulp and stares into space. He is no longer the perfect husband, and, oddly enough, this makes me happy. We leave the bar and walk back to the hotel. Along the way, we find a beautiful and charming restaurant, but we've already made reservations elsewhere. It's still early. The sign says dinner service doesn't start until 7 p.m.
Let's have another gin.
Who is this man next to me? Has Interlaken awakened forgotten memories and opened up Pandora's box? I say nothing, and I begin to be afraid. I ask if we should cancel our reservation at the Italian restaurant and have dinner here instead.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter? Is he suddenly feeling everything I went through when he thought I was depressed? For me, it does matter. I want to go to the restaurant we booked, the same one where we exchanged vows of love.
This trip was a terrible idea. I'd rather go back tomorrow. I had good intentions. I wanted to relive the early days of our relationship. But is that even possible? Of course not. We're mature. We're living under pressures that didn't exist before. We need to maintain basic needs like education, health care, food. We try to have fun on the weekends because that's what everybody does. And when we don't feel like leaving the house, we think there's something wrong with us.
I never want to. I'd rather do nothing.
Me too. But what about our children? They want something else. We can't leave them locked up with their computers. They're too young for that. So we force ourselves to take them somewhere and do the same things our parents did with us, the same thing our grandparents did with our parents. An ordinary life. We're an emotionally well-structured family. If one of us needs help, the other is always ready to do anything.
I understand. Like taking a trip to a place filled with memories, for example. Another glass of gin. He sits in silence for a while before replying.
That's right. But do you think memories can fill the present?
Not at all.
In fact, they're suffocating me. I'm discovering I'm no longer the same person. Until we got here and had that bottle of champagne, everything was fine. Now I realize just how far I am from living the life I dreamed of when I visited Interlaken the first time.
What did you dream?
It was silly, but it was still my dream. And I could have made it come true.
But what was it?
Sell everything I had, buy a boat, and travel the world with you. My father would have been furious that I didn't follow in his footsteps. But it wouldn't have mattered. We'd stop off at ports, do odd jobs until we earned enough to move on, and as soon as we had enough money, we'd set sail again. Be with people we'd never seen before and discover places not listed in the guidebooks. Adventure. My only wish was adventure.
He orders another glass of gin and drinks it at unprecedented speed. I stop drinking because I'm already feeling nauseated. We haven't had anything to eat. I'd like to say that I would have been the happiest woman in the world if he'd gotten his wish. But I had better keep quiet or he'll feel worse.
Then came the first child.
So? There must be millions of couples with children doing exactly what he suggested. He reflects a bit.
I wouldn't say millions. Maybe thousands.
His eyes change. They no longer show aggression, but sadness.
There are times when we should stop to take a look at the whole picture, our past and our present, what we have learned and the mistakes we made. I was always afraid of those moments. I trick myself, telling myself that I made the best choices and had to make a few small sacrifices, nothing major.
I suggest we walk a bit. His eyes are starting to get weird, dull. He slams his fist on the table. The waitress looks frightened, and I order another glass of gin for me. She refuses. It's time to close the bar because dinner will begin soon, and she brings the bill. I wonder how my husband will react. But he just gets out his wallet and throws some money on the counter. He takes my hand, and we go out in the cold.
I'm afraid that if I think too much about everything that could have been and never was, I'll fall into a dark hole.
I know that feeling. We talked about this at the restaurant when I opened up to you. He doesn't seem to hear.
Deep down, there's a voice telling me, none of this makes sense. The universe has existed for billions of years, and it will continue to exist after you die. We live in a microscopic part of a gigantic mystery, and we still have no answers to our childhood questions. Is there life on another planet? If God is good, why does he allow suffering and the pain of others? And what's worse, time continues to pass. Often for no apparent reason, I feel an immense dread. Sometimes it's when I'm at work, sometimes in the car, and sometimes when I put the kids to bed. I look at them lovingly, afraid. What will happen to them? They live in a country that gives us peace and security. But what about the future?
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I imagine we are not the only ones to think that way.
Then I see you making breakfast or dinner, and occasionally I think that 50 years from now, or maybe even less, one of us will be sleeping alone, crying every night because once we were happy. The children will be all grown up and far away. The surviving one of us will be sick, always needing help from strangers.
He stops talking and we walk in silence. We pass by a sign announcing a New Year's Eve party. He kicks it violently. Two or three passers-by look at us.
Forgive me. I didn't mean to say all that. I brought you here to make you feel better without all the daily pressures. Blame it on the booze.
I'm stunned. We pass by a group of young men and women who are talking animatedly among the beer cans scattered everywhere. My husband, usually shy and serious, approaches them and invites them to have another drink. The young people look frightened. I apologize, hinting that we're both drunk and one drop more of alcohol might lead to catastrophe. I grab his arm and we carry on. How long has it been since I've done that? He was always the protector, the helper, the problem solver. Now I'm the one trying to keep him from skidding and falling. His mood has changed again, and now he's singing a song I've never heard. Perhaps a traditional song of that region. When we approach the church, the bells ring again. That's a good sign, I say.
I listen to the bells. They speak of God. But is God listening to us? We're in our 30s, and life isn't fun anymore. if not for our children, what would be the point of all this?
I prepare myself to say something, but I have no answer. We arrive at the restaurant where we exchanged our first words of love and have a depressing candlelight dinner in one of the most beautiful and most expensive cities in Switzerland. When I awake, there's already daylight outside. I had a dreamless sleep and didn't wake up in the middle of the night. I look at the clock. 9 a.m. My husband is still sleeping. I go to the bathroom, brush my teeth, and order breakfast for the two of us. I put on a robe and go to the window to pass the time while I wait for the room service to arrive. At this point, I notice something. The sky is full of paragliders. They land in the park opposite the hotel. Most are not alone and have an instructor behind them steering. First-timers. How can they do such a crazy thing? Have we reached the point where risking our life is the only thing that frees us from boredom? Another paraglider lands, and another. Friends film everything, smiling cheerfully. I wonder what the view must be like up there, because the mountains surrounding us are very, very high. Although I envy every one of those people, I would never have the courage to jump. The doorbell rings. The waiter enters with a silver tray, a vase with a rose, coffee for my husband, tea for me, croissants, hot toast, rye bread, jams of various flavors, eggs, orange juice, the local newspaper, and everything else that makes us happy. I wake him up with a kiss. I don't remember the last time I did that. He is startled, but then smiles. We sit at the table and savor the treats in front of us. We talk a bit about our drinking spree last night.
I think I needed that. But don't take what I said too seriously. When a balloon bursts, it startles everyone. But it's nothing more than that. A bursting balloon. Harmless.
I want to say it felt great to discover all his weaknesses, but I just smile and keep eating my croissant. He also notices the paragliders. His eyes light up. We get dressed and go downstairs to enjoy the morning. We go straight to the front desk. He says we'll be leaving today, asks them to bring down our suitcases, and pays the bill. Are you sure? Can't we stay until tomorrow morning?
I'm sure. Last night was enough for me to understand that it's impossible to go back in time.
We head to the door, crossing the long glass-ceilinged lobby. I read in one of the brochures that there used to be a street here. Now they've joined the two buildings that stood on either side. Tourism is apparently thriving, even without ski slopes. But instead of going out the door, my husband turns left and approaches the concierge.
How can we go paragliding?
We? I don't have the slightest intention of doing that. The concierge hands him a brochure. It's all there.
And how do we get up top?
The concierge explains that we don't have to go all the way up. The road is very treacherous. All we have to do is set a time, and they'll pick us up from the hotel. Isn't it very dangerous? Jumping into the nothing between two mountain ranges without ever having done it before? Who is in charge? Are there any government controls on the instructors and their equipment?
Madame, I've been working here for 10 years. I paraglide at least once a year. I've never seen a single accident.
He is smiling. He must have repeated those words thousands of times over those 10 years.
Shall we?
What? Why don't you go alone?
Sure, I can go by myself. You can wait for me down here with the camera. But I need and want to have this experience in life. It's always terrified me. Just yesterday we talked about when everything gets stuck in a rut and how we no longer test our limits. It was a very sad night for me.
I know. He asks the concierge to set a time.
Now? This morning or in the afternoon when you can see the sunset reflected on the surrounding snow?
Now, I reply.
So will it be one person or two?
Two if we do it now. If I don't have a chance to think about what I'm doing, if I don't have time to open the box and let the demons out, fear of heights, of the unknown, of death, of life, of extreme feelings. Now or never?
We have the option of 20-minute, half-hour, and 1-hour flights.
Are there 10-minute flights?
No. Would you like to jump from 1,350 or 1,800 meters?
I'm already starting to back down. I didn't need all this information. Of course I want the lowest possible jump.
Darling, that makes no sense. I'm sure nothing will happen, but if it did, the danger is the same. Falling from 21 meters, or the equivalent of the 7th floor of a building, would have just the same consequences.
The concierge laughs. I laugh to hide my feelings. How could I have been so naive to think that a measly 500 meters would make any difference? The concierge picks up the phone and talks to someone.
There is only space available for jumps at 1,350 meters.
More absurd than my earlier fear is the relief I feel now. Oh, good. The car will be at the hotel doorstep in 10 minutes. I stand before the chasm with my husband and 5 or 6 other people waiting for my turn. On the way up, I thought about my children and the possibility of losing their parents. Then I realized we wouldn't be jumping together. We put on special thermal outfits and helmets. Why the helmet? So my skull will still be intact if I hit a rock and skip 3,000 feet to the ground? The helmet is mandatory. Perfect. I put on the helmet, just like the ones worn by cyclists on the streets of Geneva. Completely stupid, but I won't argue. I look ahead. Between us and the chasm is a snow-covered slope. I can stop the flight in the first second by landing there and walking back up. I don't have to go all the way to the end. I've never been afraid of flying. It's always been a part of my life. But the thing is, when we're in a plane, it doesn't occur to us that it's exactly the same as going paragliding. The only difference is that the metal cocoon feels like a shield and gives us the feeling that we're protected. That's it.
That's it?
In my meager understanding of the laws of aerodynamics, I suppose so. I need to convince myself. I need a better argument. This is a better argument. The airplane is made of metal. It's extremely heavy. And it carries luggage, people, equipment, and tons of explosive fuel. The paraglider, in turn, is light, descends with the wind, and obeys the laws of nature like a leaf falling from a tree. It makes much more sense.
Do you want to go first?
Yes, I do. Because if something happens to me, you'll know and can take care of our children. And you'll feel guilty for the rest of your life for having this insane idea. I will be remembered as a companion for all seasons, one who always stood by her husband's side in sorrow and in joy, adventure and routine.
We are ready, madame.
Are you the instructor? Aren't you too young for this? I'd rather go with your boss. It's my first time, after all.
I've been jumping since I reached the age minimum of 16. I've been jumping for 5 years. Not just here, but many different places around the world. Don't worry, madame.
His condescending tone annoys me. Old people and their fears should be respected. Besides, he must tell everybody that.
Remember the instructions, and when we start to run, don't stop. Let me take care of the rest.
Instructions. As if we were now familiar with all of this, when the most they had the patience to explain was that the risk lies exactly in wanting to stop in the middle, and that when we reach the ground, we should keep walking until we feel our feet firmly fixed. My dream. Feet on the ground. I go to my husband and ask him to go last. Then he'll have time to see what happens to me.
Want to bring the camera?
Asks the instructor. The camera can be attached to an aluminum rod approximately 2 feet long. No, I do not. For starters, I'm not doing this to show other people. And even if I can overcome my panic, I'd be more worried about filming than admiring the scenery. I learned that with my dad when I was a teenager. We hiked the Matterhorn, and I stopped every minute to take pictures until he fumed,
"Do you think all this beauty and grandeur can fit in a little square of film? Record things in your heart. It's more important than trying to show people what you're experiencing."
My flight partner, in all his wisdom of 21 years, begins attaching ropes to my body with big aluminum clips. The chair is attached to the glider. I will go in front, he in the back. I can still give up, but that's no longer me. I'm completely unresponsive. The 21-year-old veteran and the ringleader trade opinions about the wind as we get into position. He also fastens himself to the chair. I can feel his breath on the back of my head. I look behind me, and I don't like what I see. A row of colored pieces of fabric stretches across the white snowy ground, each with a person tied to it. At the end of the row is my husband, also wearing a bicycle helmet. I guess he had no choice and will jump 2 or 3 minutes after me.
We're ready. Start running.
I don't move.
Let's go. Start running.
I explain that I don't want to keep twirling around in the sky. Let's go down gently. 5 minutes of flight is good for me.
You can let me know while we're flying, but please, there's a line. We have to jump now.
As I no longer have free will, I follow orders. I start running toward the void.
Faster!
I go faster, my boots kicking snow in all directions. Actually, it's not me who is running, but a robot who obeys voice commands. I start to scream, not from fear or excitement, but from instinct. I've gone back to being a cavewoman, like the Cuban shaman said. We're afraid of spiders and insects, and we scream in situations like this. We've always screamed. Suddenly, my feet lift off the ground, and I hold on to the belt, securing me to the chair with all my might. I stop screaming. The instructor keeps running for a few more seconds, and then immediately, we're no longer going in a straight line. The wind is controlling our lives. I don't open my eyes that first minute. I don't want a concept of height, the mountains, the danger. I try to imagine that I'm at home in the kitchen, telling the kids a story about something that happened during our trip, maybe about the town, or maybe about the hotel room. I can't tell them their father drank so much he fell down when we were headed back to the hotel. I can't say I took a risk and went flying, because they'll want to do it too. Or worse, they might try to fly alone and throw themselves from the top floor of our house. Then I realize I'm being stupid. Why be here with my eyes closed? No one made me jump.
I've been here for 10 years and have never seen a single accident, said the concierge.
I open my eyes, and what I see, what I feel, is something I will never be able to accurately describe. Down below is the valley linking the two lakes and the town between them. I'm flying, free in space and silence as we follow the wind, sailing in circles. The mountains surrounding us no longer seem so high or threatening, but friendly, dressed in white, with the sun glistening all round. My hands relax. I let go of the straps, and I open my arms like a bird. The man behind me must have realized that I'm a different person. Instead of continuing down, he starts to rise, using invisible currents of warm air in what once seemed like a homogeneous atmosphere. Ahead of us is an eagle, sailing the same ocean and effortlessly using its wings to control its mysterious flight. Where does it want to go? Is it just having fun, enjoying life and the beauty all around it? It feels like I'm communicating with the eagle by telepathy. The flight instructor follows it, our guide. Show us where we need to go to climb increasingly skyward, to fly forever. I feel the same thing I felt that day in Nyon when I imagined running until my body couldn't run anymore. And the eagle tells me, "Come. You are heaven and earth, the wind and the clouds, the snow and the lakes." It seems like I'm in my mother's womb, completely safe and protected, and experiencing things for the first time. Soon I will be born, and I will turn back into a human being who walks with 2 feet on the face of the earth. At the moment, though, all I am doing is existing in this womb, putting up no resistance, and letting myself go wherever I'm taken. I'm free. Yes, I'm free. And the eagle is right. I am the mountains and the lakes. I have no past, present, or future. I am getting to know what people call eternity. For a split second, I wonder, does everyone who jumps have this same feeling? But what does that matter? I don't want to think about others. I'm floating in eternity. Nature speaks to me as if I were its beloved daughter. The mountain tells me, "You have my strength." The lakes tell me, "You have my peace and my calm." The sun tells me, "Shine like me. Go beyond yourself. Listen." I start to hear the voices that have been stifled inside for so long, stifled by haunting thoughts, by loneliness, by night terrors, the fear of change, and the fear that everything will stay the same. The higher we go, the further I distance myself from me. I'm in another world where things fall perfectly into place. Far from that life full of chores to do, impossible desires, suffering and pleasure. I have nothing, and I am everything. The eagle begins to turn toward the valley. With open arms, I mimic the movement of its wings. If anyone could see me right now, they wouldn't know who I am, because I am light, space, and time. I'm in another world. And the eagle tells me, this is eternity. In eternity, we don't exist. We are just an instrument of the hand that created the mountains, the snow, the lakes, and the sun. I go back in time and space to the moment when everything is created and the stars walk backward. I want to serve this hand. Several ideas appear and disappear without changing the way I feel. My mind has left my body and blended with nature. Oh, what a pity the eagle and I must land at the park across from the hotel down below. But what does it matter what will happen in the future? I am here, in this womb made of nothing and everything. My heart fills every corner of the universe. I try to explain this to myself in words, try to find a way to remember what I feel right now. But soon these thoughts disappear, and emptiness returns to fill everything once again. My heart. Before, I saw a gigantic universe around me. And now, the universe seems like a little dot within my heart that has infinitely expanded, like space. An instrument. A blessing. My mind struggles to maintain control and explain at least something that I'm feeling. But the power is stronger. Power. The feeling of eternity gives me a mysterious feeling of power. I can do anything, even end world suffering. I am flying and talking with the angels, hearing voices and revelations that will soon be forgotten, but that, at this moment, are as real as the eagle before me. I will never be capable of explaining what I feel, not even to myself. But what does it matter? It's the future. And I'm not there yet. I'm in the present. The rational mind disappears again, and I am grateful. I bow to my gigantic heart filled with light and power, which can encompass everything that has already happened and what will happen from now until the end of time. For the first time, I hear something. Dogs barking. We are nearing the ground and reality begins to return. In a moment, I will be stepping on the planet where I live. But in my heart, I have experienced all the planets and all the suns, which was greater than anything. I want to stay in this state, but my thoughts are returning. I see our hotel to the right. The lakes are already hidden by the forests and small hills. My God, can't I stay this way forever? You cannot, says the eagle, who led us to the park where we will land shortly, and who now bids us farewell because it has found a new stream of warm air. It climbs up again effortlessly, without batting its wings, and controls the wind with its feathers.
If you stayed this way forever, you couldn't live in this world, it says.
So what? I begin to argue with the eagle, but I find that I am doing it rationally, trying to reason. How will I live in this world after having gone through what I did in eternity?
Find a way, replies the eagle, almost inaudibly.
Then it departs forever from my life. The instructor whispers something. He reminds me that I have to run when my feet hit the ground. I see the grass in front of me. The thing I had so yearned for before, reaching solid ground, has now turned into the end of something.
Of what exactly?
My feet hit the ground. I run a little, and the instructor controls the paraglider. Then he comes up to me and loosens the chains. He looks at me. I gaze at the sky. All I can see are other colorful paragliders approaching where I am. I realize that I am crying.
Are you all right?
I nod, yes. I don't know if he understands what I experienced up there. Yes, he understands. He says that once a year he flies with someone who has the same reaction as me.
When I ask what it is, they aren't able to explain it. The same thing happens to my friends. Some people go into a state of shock, and they only recover when their feet touch the ground.
It's exactly the opposite. But I don't feel like explaining anything. I thank him for his comforting words. I would like to explain that I never wanted what I experienced up there to end. But it's over, and I have no obligation to sit here explaining anything to anyone. I walk away to sit on one of the park benches and wait for my husband. I can't stop crying. He lands, approaches me with a big grin, and says it was a fantastic experience. I keep crying. He hugs me, says it's all over now and that he shouldn't have made me do something I didn't want to. It's not that at all, I say. Just leave me alone, please. I'll be fine in a little while. Someone from the support team comes to collect our outfits and special shoes and hands us our coats. I do everything automatically, but my every move brings me back to a different world, the one we call the real world, the one where I don't want to be at all. But I have no choice. The only thing I can do is ask my husband to leave me alone for a while. He asks if we should go back to the hotel because it's cold. No, I'm fine right here. I sit there for half an hour, crying. Tears of bliss that wash my soul. Finally, I realize that it is time to return to the world for good. I get up, we go to the hotel, get our car, and my husband drives back to Geneva. The radio is on, so no one feels compelled to talk. I gradually begin to get a terrible headache, but I know what it is. My blood returning to parts that were blocked by emotions that are finally beginning to dissolve. The moment of release is accompanied by pain. but it's always been that way. He doesn't need to explain what he said yesterday. I don't need to explain what I felt today. The world is perfect. In just 1 hour, the year will come to an end. The city decided on significant spending cuts for Geneva's traditional New Year's Eve celebrations, so we will have fewer fireworks. It's just as well. I've seen fireworks my whole life, and they no longer give me the same thrill as they did when I was a child. I cannot say I'm going to miss these past 365 days. The wind blew, lightning struck, and the sea nearly capsized my boat. But in the end, I managed to cross the ocean and reach dry land. Dry land? No relationship should go off in search of that. What kills a relationship between two people is precisely the lack of challenge, the feeling that nothing is new anymore. We need to continue to be a surprise for each other. It all begins with a big party. Friends come out. The celebrant says things he's repeated at hundreds of weddings, like that idea of building a house on rock and not on sand. The guests throw rice, we throw the bouquet. The single women secretly envy us, and the married women know we are starting on a path that is not at all like what we've read about in fairy tales. And then reality gradually begins to set in, but we don't accept it. We want our partner to remain the person we met at the altar and with whom we exchanged rings, as if we could stop time. We cannot. We should not. Wisdom and experience don't change the man. Time doesn't change the man. The only thing that changes us is love. While I was in the air, I understood that my love for life, for the universe, was more powerful than anything. I remember a sermon written by a young, unknown 19th-century pastor analyzing the epistle of St. Paul to the Corinthians and the various sides that love reveals as it grows. He tells us that many of the spiritual texts we see today are addressed to only one part of man. They offer peace, but do not speak of life. They discuss faith, but forget love. They tell us about justice, and do not mention revelation, like the one I had when I jumped from the precipice in Interlaken, and the one that got me out of the black hole I had dug in my soul. May it always be clear that only true love can compete with any other love in this world. When we give everything, we have nothing more to lose. And then fear, jealousy, boredom, and monotony disappear. And all that remains is the light from a void that does not frighten us, but brings us closer to one another. The light that always changes, and that is what makes it beautiful and full of surprises, not always those we hope for, but those we can live with. To love abundantly is to live abundantly. To love forever is to live forever. Eternal life is coupled with love. Why do we want to live forever? Because we want to live another day with this person by our side. Because we want to keep going with someone who deserves our love and who knows how to love us as we think we deserve to be loved. Because living is loving. Even love for a pet, a dog, for example, can justify the life of a human being. If he no longer has this bond of love in his life, any reason to keep on living also disappears. Let us first seek love, and everything else will be added. During these 10 years of marriage, I have enjoyed almost every pleasure a woman can have and had to bear things I did not deserve. Yet, when I look back, there were only a few moments, usually very short, when I was able to find even a poor imitation of what I imagine true love to be. The birth of my children, when I sat holding hands with my husband and looking at the Alps, or the enormous jet of water in Lake Geneva. But these few moments are what justify my existence, because they give me the strength to keep going and bring joy to my days, no matter how much I tried to bring them sorrow. I go to the window and look at the city outside. The snow they had promised did not fall. Still, I think this is one of the most romantic New Year's Eves I have ever had, because I was dying, and love revived me. Love, the only thing that will remain when the human race has died out. Love. My eyes well up with tears of joy. No one can force himself to love, nor can he force another person. All you can do is look at love, fall in love with love, and imitate it. There is no other way to achieve love, and there is no mystery about it. We love others, we love ourselves, we love our enemies, and then we will never want for anything in our lives. I can turn on the television and see what is happening around the world because, as long as a bit of love exists in these tragedies, we are heading for salvation. Because love begets more love. Those who know how to love, love truth, rejoice with the truth, and do not fear it, because sooner or later, it redeems everything. They seek the truth with a clear, humble mind, lacking prejudice or intolerance, and are ultimately satisfied with what they find. Perhaps the word sincerity isn't the best way to explain this characteristic of love, but I can't find any other. I'm not talking about the sincerity that demeans those close to you. True love does not consist of exposing your weaknesses to others, but instead of being unafraid to show when you need help, and rejoicing in finding that things are better than what others said. I think fondly of Jacob and Marianne. Unwittingly, they brought me back to my husband and my family. I hope they are happy on this last night of the year, and that all this also brought them closer together. Am I trying to justify my adultery? No. I sought truth, and I found it. I hope it's like that for everyone who has had this experience. Learn to love better. This should be our goal in the world. Learn to love. Life offers us thousands of opportunities for learning. Every man and every woman in every day of our lives always has a good opportunity to surrender to love. Life is not a long vacation, but a constant learning process. And the most important lesson is learning to love. Loving better and better, because the languages, the countries, the solid Swiss Confederation, Geneva, and the street where I live with its lampposts, our house, the living room furniture, it will all disappear. And my body will disappear too. But one thing will be forever marked on the soul of the universe. My love. All in spite of my mistakes, my decisions that caused others to suffer, and the moments when I thought it didn't exist. I leave the window and call out to my children and husband. I say that, according to tradition, we have to climb up on the sofa in front of the fireplace and, exactly at midnight, step on the floor with our right foot.
Darling, it's snowing.
I rush to the window again and look at the light of one of the street lamps. Yes, it's snowing. How had I not noticed before?
Can we go outside?
Asks one of the children. Not yet. First we will climb on the sofa, eat 12 grapes, and save the seeds to have prosperity all year long. We will do everything we learned from our ancestors. Then we will go outside to celebrate life. I am sure that the new year will be excellent. Geneva, November 30, 2013. This is Susan Deniker. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Adultery by Paulo Coelho, translated from the Portuguese by Margaret Yule Costa and Zoe Perry. This program was directed by Jill Whitesides, executive producer Aaron Blank. Translation copyright 2014 by Margaret Yule Costa and Zoe Perry. Originally published in Brazil as Adulterio by Sextant, Rio de Janeiro in 2012. Text copyright 2012 by Paulo Coelho. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.